The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Hello, I'm your host, Beverly Prentice, and you're listening to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, myth, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com. Thank you. Inferno by James Scott. A single green shoot, pushing up from between the slightest of gaps in the dusty concrete, almost seemed to be enjoying throwing a minute splash of color against the dead landscape. Too young to classify as anything beyond simple life, Cassian knew upon catching sight of it that come dawn, the beautiful green thread would be reduced to nothing but another muted, dry husk. He looked up from his study of the infant plant to monitor the hazy glow on the horizon that signaled the imminent rising sun, the heat of it already evaporating any humidity of the dark night. It was time to move. He placed a gentle hand on his sleeping sister's shoulder. "Sarah, time to suit up," he said in a soft voice. Her eyes snapped open so quickly that he caught her pupils contracting against the glowing light. She shot bolt upright and shook her head as if to hurl away the remnants of sleep. "Look at the light, Cassian. Damn it, I told you not to leave it so late. I'd rather be allowed time to get ready without being chased by the sun." "You need the sleep," he replied, standing and brushing accumulated red dirt from the tight black anti-thermal layer that made up his only clothing. "Being tired is better than being dead. Wake me earlier tomorrow, or I'll start taking the last watch." An accusatory finger let him know she was serious. Thankfully, his lack of reply ended the argument there. In truth, she was right that their time was now tight. Passing her suit over seemed to act as enough of a peace offering. Cassian stepped into his own outfit while Sarah saw to herself. The shining silver all-in-one reminded him of the science fiction movies he had loved as a child, before computers were able to generate images akin to reality. He had believed entirely that the cheap costumes made from everyday bits and pieces were genuine spacemen and monsters. Zipping up his heat-proof cocoon, he felt like an astronaut from one of those early films, except that in this case the fabric barrier would genuinely mean the difference between living or dying. He secured the encompassing hood in place and looked down to check himself over through its narrow viewfinder. Everything looked good, so he hit the series of buttons on his wrist to ignite the cooling fans and immediately felt the sweet, icy breeze against his skin. "All set?" he asked of his sister in an intentionally louder voice to be heard through the layers of both suits. "Yeah, I'm good. Let's get going," she replied. Before leaving, Cassian took one last look at the emerging seedling that had captivated his attention all morning, and with a shake of his head turned away before the color completely drained from it. The vulnerable pioneer had visibly dried out and rapidly died under the emerging sunlight. Over an hour of staring at Sarah's back followed. Their daily routine of crossing the barren, sandy soil of the old parklands, weaving between charcoal tree stumps to reach the city proper, played out the same as it had every day for the past week. Pushing the empty wheelbarrow across the shifting grains was tricky, but far easier in this direction. The way back would be far worse, with tired arms and hopefully heavily laden. The solid green wood wheel hindered Cassian's progression, but it was the only real choice over rubber that would melt or metal that could spark. He kept watch over Sarah as she navigated her own barrow across the desert-like landscape, avoiding the tarmac paths that could liquefy in the rising heat, and watching for the never, ever more active snakes of the region. He had always felt protective over her, as an older brother should. The feeling was amplified all the more by their presence in the dead zone. Having convinced her to accompany him, as the only person he could ever trust, truly, and more so on account of being too cowardly to go alone. She now faced this danger by his request, and so her life was in his hands. She stopped ahead under the shade of an abandoned overpass, as agreed, since the next few minutes would see them enter the city for real. He gently lowered the handles of his adapted wheelbarrow alongside her and checked his wrist display. 45 centigrade, 113 Fahrenheit, already. If today's temperature follows the same gradient, which it always does, we are on track for the hottest day of the year. Could reach 65 centigrade, 149 Fahrenheit at noon. We need to be even more careful than usual. Go gently. No metal, no sparks. Move slowly, he warned Sarah. Maybe we should head back? Try again tomorrow? It might not be as bad, she offered. Cassian paused, seriously considering the suggestion for a moment. No. We are here now, and there's only a few days left before we need to make the journey back east. Just go more carefully. Okay, I trust you, brother. Why don't we head away from the city center today? How about that rich neighborhood? Walkerville, was it? Yeah, that's right. We used to go there, you know, but you probably wouldn't remember. You were too young. They had this supermarket that was like a whole luxury experience. Food draped over every surface. Hard to believe everything we had back then, but it's a smart target. Let's make a run at it. He let her lead the way again, giving directions from behind. Cassian much preferred to have her in sight at all times. As they passed under the dual poles of a huge highway sign that read Adelaide, South Australia, he tried to remember his childhood home as anything other than the uninhabitable hellscape of heat that it had become. They made their way across parks and through backyards, only risking the roads when they had no other choice. The heat intensified when it reflected from the man-made surfaces, and melted tarmac was infuriating to remove from the bottom of shoes. It made for slower progress, but eventually they noticed the houses growing larger, the gardens becoming gated, and the walls showing more natural stone. They had moved into the realm of the previously wealthy. He laughed to himself at the sight. All that status meant nothing now. All right, we do one house at a time, together. I don't want to see any silver this time, Sarah. It's not worth the added weight. Gold only. Stones, sure, but remove them from anything other than the gold. With the mines in the north closed, it's the biggest payday. Remember, we have to get back everything that we scavenged 1,500 kilometers back to New Melbourne. Even using the boat, it's going to be hard going until we get back to the coast, so... Yeah, all right, Cassian, I get it. No more silver, no matter how pretty it is. He could see the mocking in her eyes through the tiny slit of her suit, and read even more humor in her head movements. Now come on, Big Brother, this is the fun bit. It's treasure hunting time. The pair pick their way through the houses, pulling out bedside drawers, emptying jewelry boxes, and grabbing any discarded wallets. The evacuation had been sudden enough that most people, who could, had just left everything behind. By the fifth house, Cassian realized they might have hit the jackpot. Every home was giving up fistfuls of gold and cash. If they kept going like this, there was a chance this could be even their last trip into the city. "Oh my God, Cass, look at this!" Sarah's voice rang down the long corridor of the stone building that they were busy ransacking. "You aren't going to believe it." He placed the watch he had uncovered onto the growing pile of valuables in his wheelbarrow and made his way slowly, carefully from the lounge down to what must have been the kitchen at the back of the house. There he found his sister digging head first through the fridge. "What are you doing in here? You know kitchens are too risky. One spark from an oven and or a drop box of matches and you could set the whole city alight, us included. This is foolish, Sarah. You were supposed to be upstairs." "Oh, shush, will you, and come look." He couldn't see her face, but a lifetime of shared body language told him that she was beaming. She spun around and held up two brightly colored plastic bags, one either side of her head, each wrapping a mass of neon worms. "Are those gummy snakes?" "Yes, a packet each." "What a score," she yelled in excitement, bouncing on the spot. "Sarah, don't torture yourself. They'll be liquid before you can take your suit off. Just like all the other packets not lucky enough to be left inside an airtight fridge." "Look, this is a once-in-a-lifetime chance. They can't make this stuff anymore. We have stumbled upon someone crazy enough to keep sweets in a fridge, and I just dug through some black stuff I couldn't even identify to reach them. I am eating these. It's worth the risk, Cass." "All for some candy?" he asked. "Yes." "Okay, fine, but I go first." He resigned, snatching one of the packets from her hand and checking the display on his wrist. 63 centigrade, 145 Fahrenheit. Holding it in one hand and the zip at his throat in the other, he took a deep breath. Then, in one fluid movement, dropped the zip, shoved the treats against his chest, and ripped the suit closed. The entire movement lasted no more than a second, but Cassian felt like someone had just opened an oven onto his chest. He waited for the discomfort and slight spike of panic to subside, then pulled his arms out of the sleeves and into the torso of his protective clothing, finding one of the joys of his childhood wedged inside. "Wow, they really are almost like new," he said, squeezing the warm package between his fingers. Before he could marvel any further at the find, his attention was diverted by the familiar sound of a zip descending. That spike of alarm hit him again, and by the time his viewfinder had raised enough to bring Sarah into focus, his eyes found her rummaging around inside her own clothes suit, giggling maniacally. Neither of them said a single word from then on, only moaned and groaned in pleasure as they worked their way through an entire bag each of sugar jellies. They hadn't even bothered to move from where they stood in the kitchen. She had been right. It was worth the risk. Cassian had forgotten what simple pleasures as these could feel like. When they had both finished, she caught his sister's demeanor changing. Her shoulders dropped, and the life seemed to visibly leach from her soul. "What's wrong? I thought you'd be happy," he asked. "I am. It's just, when were we reduced to this? That this is the pinnacle of what we can expect from life? I remember more than you think from before. I remember what it was like to have a house in a city rather than a tent in a refugee camp. I remember what it was like to have a hot meal." "Hey, look, that's why we are here. Even counting only what we have scored so far, it should be enough to get us passage, at least to New Zealand. A few more days of scavenging at this level, we might even be able to get across the Pacific and north to the truly cool countries. Australia is burning away day by day. But we have a way out. We just need to keep going. Keep believing we can do this." "I don't mean to sound bleak. I know we have options. Thanks to you and this insane adventure you've brought us on. I'm okay. I just can't help but let it get to me sometimes. Don't you ever think about what the world is becoming? Big picture, I mean. Will we ever really be safe again?" "Of course we will, you dope. We were just unlucky enough to be born in one of the hottest countries in the world. There are plenty of places out there that are doing just fine. And come winter, there will even be people venturing this far west again. Which is why we need to get a move on. Can't have them finding us still here, robbing them blind now, can we?" "You're right. Come on, let's put this sugar to good use," she said, bouncing away as if all her cares were immediately lifted. Cassian twisted his wrist while her back was turned, subtly checking the noonday temperature. 67°C, 152°F. "There it is, the hottest day of the year, of all recorded history." He swallowed his fear and hoped his little sister would never notice the terror that constantly simmered inside him. They continued their treasure hunt to the end of the street, taking several hours to move through the large houses before stepping onto the hollow straw that carpeted the last garden of the row. The house was larger than the rest, being on the corner block, and it looked promising. "Last one, okay? We need to get back out into the open before night falls," Cassian instructed. "I still don't see why we need to travel so far every day. I'm sure it would be safe enough to stay in one of these houses. Probably cooler, too." "We've been over this. You want to wake up surrounded by flames with no way out? We need to be in the open with sight lines to spot bushfires and time to escape. No, Sarah, we'll play it safe." They moved through the house in what was becoming a routine. It was scarily obvious where to look for valuables. Everyone always hid them in the same places. It was during their deconstruction of the master bedroom that Cassian heard the footsteps on the stairs. Muted, thanks to the suit, but unmistakable and close. He turned his whole body to direct the cumbersome suit at the door, just in time to see it slowly creak open toward them. No one entered, but a voice rang out from behind the thick timber shield. "Who's been sleeping in my bed?" Cassian silently raised his hand palm forward to stop Sarah from moving or reacting to the sound. They both stood there, frozen in place, staring at the open door that was hiding the stranger, not daring to breathe. "Come on now, sweeties, don't be shy. Oh, no, don't be that. Mummy just wants to tuck you in, but not in that bed." The creepy, squeaking laugh that was echoing from out of sight sent chills down Cassian's spine. He pushed his hand forward, thrusting it at his sister, urging her to remain still. "You know that's not your bed. Yours is in the nursery. Get out! Get out! Get out!" The door pushed wider, revealing a small framed woman with a thin summer dress hanging from her shriveled shoulders. Her skin was like leather, thick, rough, and dark, as if she had spent a lifetime in the scorching sun. Her eyes were wide and milky and her head cocked to one side. The whole ensemble reminded Cassian of the undead from the scariest of his old movies, the ones that he would defend against with a couch cushion. "Why aren't you listening, sweet ones? Why, oh, why won't you come to bed? This isn't your bed." Sarah's terrified eyes met Cassian's, and her barely perceptible shrug and nod toward the woman asked, "What the hell is going on?" They had both seen sunstroke before. It was commonplace among those who had escaped the heat to New Melbourne. But this was something different, something more. How this creature was still alive, Cassian could not explain. No one should be able to survive any level of exposure to the sun here. Afraid to break whatever hallucination their guest was enthralled in, he stayed quiet. Who knew how she would react to learning they were not the children she believed them to be? "I know what it is," she said, suddenly with more clarity and intention. "You're cold. You want to sleep in the warm with Mummy. Well, let's get this place warmed up, shall we?" Cassian lunged for his sister the instant he caught the shine of the lighter clasped in the eerie woman's hands. His subconscious calculated in a fraction of a second that he wouldn't make it to stop her in time, his body moving in protection of his only family. Instead, he stepped and pushed with all his might, sending Sarah backward through the second-story window and plummeting down with a crunch into the dry bushes below. As the very air caught fire around the small frame of view he had through the suit, he saw her roll onto her side and stand far below. Good. All she has to do is make it back ahead of the flames now. Passage for one is half the price, after all. The display on his wrist jumped to 1000 C, 1832 F, as the room exploded in an inferno. Routing a New Superhero by Jeff Mead. Journal Entry 236, Winter's Day, 1347. "I think that will do it. The last injection should be the correct formula to introduce plant cells into the human body. Hopefully this will allow me to use the infernal sun's power as a food source to survive in this accursed winter wasteland." Journal Entry 237, Winter's Day, 1353. "It's been almost a week, and I've been terribly sick. I can definitely tell that the bioserum I injected in myself is working. It's changing my very genetic structure. I've noticed that my eyes are turning yellow, and my skin has a green bioluminescence. I should, I guess, have thought about that fact, that my skin would be its primary source of dietary consumption if I really am turning into a plant. Does this mean I'll have to walk around naked all the time? Good thing there's no one else around to see my tree stump. LOL." Journal Entry 238, Winter's Day, 1354. first report of sun feeding. I'm totally sunburnt. I spent 3 hours topside yesterday afternoon, walking around in my birthday suit, and I'm burnt from head to ankles. I have a stupid tan line where my boots were, and there's funky tan lines also where my backpack straps were. I've been lonely for so long that I never thought I'd actually be glad no one is around to see how stupid I look. Journal entry 239, Winter's Day, 1364. It's been 10 days since my last report. I'm struggling to eat solid foods. The canned goods I have stockpiled in the bomb shelter are not staying down. I've had violent diarrhea every time I eat, and I'm maniacally thirsty. It's like I'm addicted to water. I think I'll try infusing water with fruit sugars for added nutrients. I feel like I have to start experimenting with plant fertilizer just to feed myself properly. This experiment is just getting weirder and weirder. Journal entry 240, Winter's Day, 1374. Another 10 days. I've been spending significantly more time topside naked. Emerging from the bomb shelter no longer hurts my eyes, but being inside actually does. I think my eyes have adjusted to the serum injection and become sunlight dependent. It's like my very eyeballs are sunglasses now. Journal entry 241, Sunday 1. I've pretty much stopped eating solid foods. My primary source of sustenance is now the blazing sunlight. I don't even burn anymore. I can actually feel my body absorbing the sun's rays, and there's a tingling sensation after about 30 minutes walking around. I think I can actually feel the chlorophyll in my skin cells converting around sunlight into energy. I think this mad scientist plan I had of turning myself into a plant has actually worked. I'm officially changing the name of my calendar system to Sunday, as the nuclear winter is no longer a limitation for me. I'm restarting the number system of how I count the days as well. Journal entry 242, Sunday 10. Another 10 days has gone by. I think I can officially say that I'm no longer reliant on basic human foods. I have the digestive system of a plant now, requiring only sunlight. I've decided to pack up my belongings and start searching for other survivors. The last survivor I ran into was 2 years ago, and they mentioned a settlement near Taos, New Mexico. I think I'll head down that way and see what I can find. I'll need to follow the river, though, to make sure I have water. But that's good desert country, and I'll have plenty of sunlight for food. How neat to say that. Journal entry 243, Sunday 16. It took about a week to finish packing, and I've been walking for a few days. I've walked about 60 miles, and it's a barren wasteland out here. The city of Denver is still a smoldering heap of bombed concrete and ash, and I didn't see or hear any survivors. Perhaps if I find smaller towns away from the major blast centers, I'll have more luck finding survivors. Journal entry 245, Sunday 30. Another 10 days have gone by. I've walked a long way and still haven't seen anyone. Am I the only survivor? I have to believe that's not the case. Journal entry 246, Sunday 36. I found people. I'm just outside Chama, New Mexico, and I found a small village that's established like a trading post. I got some strange looks because it's not every day that A, a wanderer comes in from the wasteland, and B, wastelanders probably don't stroll around wearing only a loincloth. I've even stopped wearing shoes because my feet are bark-like now, so I don't even need any foot protection. And I'm overall just a green color now, so that scared quite a few people. But these folks who call themselves Chamites were overall hospitable. They don't see me as a threat, although they were rightfully wary at first. I had a great meeting with a group of 5 townspeople, 3 women and 2 men, who gave me a bit of their history. They said they've been in Chama ever since the bombs went off. The bombs tended to hit any sizable population center or anywhere that there were military installations. So Chama was saved, as it's always been a small crossroads between Colorado and New Mexico, and not deemed a military target. I spent enough time with the town council to understand that these are not warlike people, but they've been having trouble with a group of local raiders that are desperately trying to break into the underground quarters where the people are. Most of the surface level of Chama has been pilfered by this group of marauders, and they want my help, as I seem to be the only one who can openly traverse the surface without suffering health consequences. I think I'll help this group, and maybe they'll let me stay on with them. Journal entry 247, Sunday, 40. I've been out in the waste for over a week, surveying the band of raiders harassing the Chamites. There's about 20 of these scoundrels, but it's hard to tell who's who, because they are covered head to toe in rags and gear to protect from the sun. They've got a cage of Chama captives sitting out in the sun, and they absolutely torment these poor people. The town council told me that I could bring the captives back to the Chama underground if I can figure out how to spring them. Journal entry 249, Sunday 52. I got a hold of one of the smaller raiders and stashed him in a pile of rocks outside their encampment. He was terrified of my green skin and thought I was an alien. I laughed at that, as Roswell isn't too far away. But I realized that I have the power to make roots and plants grow now. And I used them to wrap this guy up. Pretty awesome superpower. I'm going to go into camp while everyone is sleeping and quietly wrap vines around the doors of their poorly built housing structures. I'll free the captives and come back for my prisoner tomorrow. As soon as the sun goes down and everyone is sleeping, I'll make my move. Journal entry 250, Sunday 53. Last night was terrifying, but successful. I got rolling late, as most of the raiders stayed up drinking some kind of homemade moonshine. Most of them were drunk as skunks by the time they went to bed, so I didn't have to be as quiet as I had thought. But I was sneaky and silent and terrified beyond anything I've experienced since the day the bombs fell 12 years ago. Heart thumping out of my chest and skin tingling with anxious excitement, I made my move. I crept into camp and tested my powers of growing plants. Reaching out my hands, I concentrated on extending my fingertips. Little shoots sprung out of the ground wherever I directed my focus, literally willing plant life to emerge. These neophyte plants grew up, and I was able to use my mind to twist them all together. Once I had created a thick latticework over the door of the first hut, I focused on hardening these green shoots and turning them into brambles. This made them thick and tough, almost like dead vines. And the beautiful thing is that this only took about a minute of deep concentration. I moved from hut to hut, keeping a careful watch for any guard patrolling the camp. But these raiders didn't feel the need to be cautious, convinced they were the only ones foolhardy enough to survive topside in the wastes. The sun is so strong on the surface that it burns anything in its view. So I quietly crept from one hut to another, closing off doors and windows. In about an hour, I had the whole camp on lockdown. Just before sunrise, I headed towards the cage holding the captives. There were seven of them and looked almost dead. Skin burnt, hair frizzled and dehydrated almost beyond salvaging. I quietly dispatched the lone guard, with the captives watching in wide-eyed fascination at this green plant man. They had just enough strength to sneak back to my hideout in the rocks where I had left the last captive. We decided to leave him trussed up, either for dead or for finding by his comrades. It took us nearly 3 days to get back to the Chama underground. I grew a crop of cactus plants, and cutting them open created enough fresh water to rehydrate the captives just enough for the journey to safety. The people of Chama were ecstatic that I had freed their family and friends and regarded me as a superhero. They asked what they could call me. I said, "Call me Chlorophyll." Movable Beast by Maria Davana Headley. It's late on a Thursday afternoon when I meet the guy who turns out to be the beast collector. I'm not expecting anything life-changing from anyone walking in the door at the Bastardville Dreamery Creamery. I got over possibility when I was 7, right along with Santa Claus and Easter Bunny and Tooth Fairy. All I've got left is suspicion. Then Billy Beecham shows up at my job and changes everything. I work in an ice cream shop. The two P's are on purpose. It looks like something out of a Norman Rockwell painting, but it's well known in these parts as the worst ice cream shop in the history of the world. Not that the ice cream is bad. It comes from the same delivery truck that every other town's ice cream comes from. It's frozen. It's quiescent. The bad isn't in the ice cream. It's in the attitude. Just like every other ice cream shop employee anywhere, I wear a pink smock and a visor, and I scoop as though my life depends on it. Then I hand over the ice cream and say, "Have a miserable day." Tourists get a huge charge out of it. They want me to say it again and again, but unless they order something else, it's not in my job description. One day in question, the guy in question comes up to my counter and orders vanilla, which is already against my rules. Then he continues, "I bet you have a nice smile," he says. "Do you know how many people have died trying that?" I ask him and adjust my visor. The answer is very zero. "Only takes one," he says. "You look like you want to." I do not. "Come on," he says. "It's been a hell of an afternoon hunting out there in the mini forest. I just need to see a pretty girl smile." He checks my name badge. "Angela." I'm Billy Beecham. I'm a beast collector with the have a miserable day, I tell him. Except that miserable is not the word I use. I use a rather more explosive word, a word we all know is a breach of protocol, but he's breaching too. Billy Beecham leans over the plexiglass barrier and tries to kiss me. He's face down in a tub of Peppy Ripple before I even know what I've done. Every girl in Bastardville takes a semester of self-defense in second grade. I hadn't realized the neck pinch skill was still part of my physical vocabulary. What do you mean, beast collector? I ask him. But he doesn't answer. His face is covered in melt. His pith helmet. Yes, he's wearing a pith helmet. Has sprinkles stuck to the top. He grins, licks the ice cream from around his lips, and walks out of the dreamy creamy like he's done nothing wrong. There's only one beast here, I yell after him, and that beast isn't collectible, just so you know. It's not my fault. I'm doing a good deed. I'm trying to save him. People are stupid sometimes. I'll see you later, Angela, the collector tosses over his shoulder. I'm apprehended by my supervisor, Phil, who drags me into the supply closet and says, "No swearing, Andrea. Bastardville is a family town." Phil can't remember my name, even though he's my age and has known me since kindergarten. All towns are family towns, Phil, I say. You're not a nice person, says Phil. You shouldn't be around the ice cream. He backs out of the supply closet. Stay in here and think about the error of your ways. I don't have to be a nice person, I tell Phil. This isn't a nice place. My town started about 100 years ago as a utopian community in a beautiful forest. The forest got littler and we got bigger and the whole utopia thing began to melt down. By the time people realized that the woods were shrinking, we'd become a town surrounding a one-block-by-one-block mini-forest. But obviously, by that point, we'd figured some things out, and it was necessary to stay. The Chamber of Commerce sent out a survey 9 years ago in an attempt at attracting tourists, and that was when we renamed ourselves Bastardville. Second runner-up was Awfulton, and third, the under-21's favorite was simply Suck. We weren't allowed to name ourselves any real swear words because maps are G-rated. Now we're visited by adventural backpackers, the occasional Japanese vacationer. Some of them decide to stay. Some of them stay forever. The beast stayed too. Bastardville, USA, population 465 plus one beast. The mini forest is the only place in town you can find any trees. Plant one elsewhere, it uproots and runs down Main Street and into the mini forest. The beast can be heard to roar from its confines every night. The whole thing is surrounded by houses on all sides. We manage things. At home, my mother is, for the second time this week, baking cream pies and smashing them into her own face. The streets belong to the mothers at night, and they like it that way. In the mornings, they make eggs, and you want to think you'll never be poisoned, but you never really know for sure. My own mother is no different. In Bastardville, you marry whomever the mothers think you ought to marry. They get together and draw names out of a hat. It's about that time for me. I'm 16, but my mother hasn't done anything about it. I'm supposed to move forward into my role, but in truth, I want a different role. I don't want to get married at all. If I thought I'd really have to, I'd walk into the mini forest. I think the beast might be preferable to Phil, or anyone else I know. My mother tried this too, but the beast didn't take her, and so she married my father. Now we're the only family in Bastardville whose father hunts the beast full time. My father moved into the mini forest about 3 years ago with his pup tent and a few cans of tomatoes. He passed me a book called Survivalism, a Primer, shook my hand, and walked into the trees without once looking back. The beast needs to be hunted. It doesn't feel satisfied unless it engages in conflict. Sometimes someone fully commits, not women, men only. I don't see Billy Beecham again until Saturday night. My friends and I are doing our usual pack wander. Normally, we do a few laps around the mini forest and then crouch on the play equipment outside the grade school and wait for something more to happen. The beast roars, but we pay it no attention. It's just talking to itself. We're just at the point of looking for something to destroy when Billy Beecham comes out of the mini forest wearing a suit, glasses, tie, briefcase in his hand, and a huge smile on his face. Nobody smiles in Bastardville. Our beast, I will say it again, is nothing collectible. Why is the collector smiling? And why did the beast roar? Maybe it was talking to Billy Beecham. But if it was, I don't know why the collector is smiling. I can feel the blood boiling in my body, so I take off running, leaving the rest of my group behind. Sometime in the middle of the night, I worry about myself. What if I belong here? The next day, I catch a glimpse of my father. I haven't seen him in months. Every other father in town can be found next to their refrigerator at 11 p.m., staring forlornly into the condiments, sometimes dipping a finger in the mustard or lapping at a jar of jam. Disgusting as that is, it'd be nice to know where my father could be found at night. All the other fathers attend their children's weddings. They get raving drunk at the reception. They're supposed to have at least one dance with their designated mother, who is, in turn, supposed to trip in her high heels and, as evening falls, go viciously at the father with her handbag and her martini glass. All fathers except mine. When I see my father, he's standing on the edge of the mini forest at the same place where Billy Beecham emerged. He's staring into space. He has a red helium balloon in one hand, and in the other, a bag of fertilizer. "Hey," I say, but he takes off running. It isn't fair that in this town of wrong, my family is wronger than everyone else. I run after him as fast as I can in my uniform stupid little pink heels, but by the time my eyes adjust to the dark of the mini forest, he's out of sight. I have, however much I don't want to think about this, a feeling. I creepily possible my father is in love with the beast. Isn't that why people move out and leave their families? I can see the balloon bobbing, and I chase that until there's a bellow and a loud pop. Then there's nothing but dark. I've never been this far into the mini forest before. The bellows of the beast are nothing you really want to hear, particularly when you aren't wearing anything resembling stalking gear. You've never managed to read any of Survivalism a Primer, and you are completely idiotically alone. The bellow happens again all around me. I get ready to leave my father to his beast, but Billy Beecham appears, wearing a trench coat and scraping a moss sample from one of the trees. There's another bellow. This one startled. "Angela," he says and winks, like it's a pleasant surprise to see me in the middle of a mini forest. "Leaving," I say. "You should too. The beast is about to be on the move. Did you see it?" he asks. "All the time," I say. From somewhere nearby, I hear my father's voice beginning to sing, "Happy birthday." I assume it's to himself. The beast's birthday is anyone's guess. I guess you could figure it out, but you'd need a chainsaw. Could things be more pathetic? I straighten my uniform and walk out in the direction I think is out anyway, which it isn't. That is, of course, implausible because of the one-block-by-one-block factor. Nevertheless, I've gotten turned around. I feel like things are spinning. I feel like the trees are taller than they were. I note the fertilizer at their feet. Billy Beecham is smiling at me when I return. "Lost?" he says. "What is it you do, anyway? You can't just be hunting this one beast," I ask, making the best of a bad situation. "Collector," he says. "Began with butterflies. Now assigned to beasts." He pulls something out of his pocket. It keeps pulling and pulling, like a magician's scarf, a net, but large enough to catch a whale in. Not big enough, poor idiot. It's not like you'll catch the beast, I tell him. No one can. You'll end up living here on the edge, and you don't want to, believe me. How do you know? Asks Billy Beecham. No one wants to live here, I tell him. We just do. We have to. We've been here a long time. Happy birthday to you, sings my father from somewhere far away. I hear him blowing out his own candles, and the mini forest gets as dark as a mini forest surrounded by street lamps can get. The mini forest also feels larger. I feel it happening, like it's taking a deep breath. Billy Beecham grabs my hand and takes off running, and I'm flying behind him like a streamer. He's making some sort of call with a whistle, a honk. The beast has never honked. My backyard border is the mini forest, and if anyone heard the voice of the beast, it's me. The beast roars. Billy Beecham stops, and I crash into him. He's swinging his net around over his head. This is not what you do with our beast. Our beast is uncatchable. Here, beast, he croons. Beast, beast, here, beast. Does it need a virgin? You'll do. I look at him. He doesn't even have the grace to blush. It doesn't need a virgin. It doesn't care about virgins. Not what I heard, Billy Beecham says, and resumes his clucking and net swinging. He has no idea how to call a beast. I decide to show him. How do you call this kind of beast? It's the kind of beast that responds to one hand clapping. So I clap against a tree trunk. It's the kind of beast that hears when a tree falls in the mini forest and there's no one around. I feel it beginning to move. There is a tearing sound and a racking sound. It's not like our beast doesn't have a history. It used to be a much bigger beast. It used to live in Scotland, and it came across the ocean on a ship it took over by talking to the planks. We keep it under control. That's why we're here, on all sides. Bastardville stands guard over our beast. The last time it got loose, it took over half the Rocky Mountains and created a whole army of pines before we got it back. Billy Beecham is staring at me. What? I ask. Are you trying to poach my beast? He says. I've already discovered that I don't like him. Forgive my momentary delusion. He belongs with his face in a tub of peppy ripple. He belongs here in the mini forest. It's not your beast, I say. It's its own beast. We just keep it boundaried. The beast starts to walk. Billy Beecham sits down abruptly, his face drained of color. I see my father peering out from behind a tree, the bag of fertilizer still in his hand. He's grinning at me as the forest tilts and lifts us up. He gives me a thumbs up. I've never seen fit to participate in this, but along with a neck pinch skill, girls get some training early on in beast management. Maybe this is my calling. Maybe I'm a hunter. Maybe I'm a gatherer. We're on the move. I think about the houses on the eastern border of the beast. This is a bad little forest. It moves around. Those houses just went back up again, but thankfully they're empty at present. The beast tends to like to walk toward the sunrise. We've learned some things over the years. Mostly the beast only moves a few feet, but today it's really shaking. The birds that have been hanging out in the beast's hair scream insulted screams and take off. I can see a little bit through the trees. We're way above the street lamps now, and the beast is maybe 20 feet in the air, walking on its taproots. Billy Beecham's mouth is hanging open. You know what the beast eats? I ask him. I don't, Billy Beecham says. Let me down. After a moment of looking at me, he increases his pitch to the high whine of someone being picked up against his will. Let me down. I feel a little bit of sympathy for him, but he is also the person who kissed me without an invitation. Collector. I don't like being collected any more than the beast does. Don't come in here thinking you can collect Bastardville's beast. Just be calm. go into the mini forest and let the beast have a snack. You'd think people would learn. Some people call us tree huggers here back when we were utopian. Some people called us weirdos. Some people called us pagans, and we were those things too. We're part of an old tradition, beast managers. And this kind of beast requires a lot of maintenance. It needs pruning and fertilizer. It needs exercise. It needs the occasional blood sacrifice. It's no big deal. That's what tourists and collectors are for. I wrap Billy Beecham's net around my hand and sling it over him, using the neck pinch skill. I wrap one end around a tree and tie a knot. I wave at my father as I walk out of the clearing so that the beast can do its beast thing. Are you going to let me be eaten? Billy Beecham looks stunned. Don't you know that sometimes beast collectors get collected? I asked him. But you're a virgin. Virgins were never sacrifices, I say. Not to this kind of beast. Virgins are collaborators. And the beast moves like it hasn't moved in 100 years. The beast dances, and I turn my head as Billy Beecham sinks into the gaping maw of the mini forest. Are you happy now? I ask the beast. The beast roars and slows its walk, dropping down into place only a little way from where it was crouching. After a moment, the birds return, and the breeze winds and winds itself back into the beast's twigs. The street lamps come back on. The mothers resume their night patrol of the streets. My father shakes a little more fertilizer on the beast's roots, and the beast sighs in satisfaction. I lean back against one of the beast's trees and kick off my dreamy, creamy high heels. I put my head back against the beast and listen to the beast's giant heart beating.